Well, first I would like to thank Monsieur Alvera and Tosi here for letting me represent the Netherlands here. This is just because I know that a lot of you are Francophone, so you can follow a little bit what I'm saying. One of the central themes of this conference or this summer school is how to observe the religious, and in particular the methodological problems of how we study religion. And I prepared as if this was an atelier or a workshop, so I rather focus not on my research results, but on the problems that we encountered of comparison. And also I would like to discuss with you how we dealt with them. And we still feel very uncomfortable, so we would like to have your suggestions on how to deal with the problems of comparison. And comparison is important, even if it's only for the funding, because I don't know about the Ramses, but in the future, European money is usually only meant not for these individual anthropologists going to different countries, but they have to work together. So the question is how to compare a study of the Virgin in Egypt, for instance, with a pilgrimage in Rome in the Middle Ages or in the 16th, 17th century. So we do have to deal with this problem of comparison. And I would like to do that by showing the problems we encountered in two projects. One is a comparative study of pilgrimage in five different countries and continents. And the second is a study of possession rituals on both sides of the Mediterranean, Northern Africa and Southern Europe. In The Power of Pilgrimage, we work together with five colleagues and a number of students, and all go to different countries. And we try to understand why in a time of secularization, especially in Western Europe, people still go on pilgrimage. For instance, the last 5 years, the number of Dutch pilgrims who have gone to Lourdes has doubled, while actually they don't go to church anymore, they still go on pilgrimage. And many of these visitors of pilgrimage centers belong to what we call the less powerful in society, women, poor, diseased people, handicapped people. And this made us to ask a certain question on why they go there, what they seek there. And we were interested in the development of power relations at these pilgrimage sites. So we understand pilgrimage centers as sites where power is negotiated, and therefore we were talking about Turner the other day and his Comunitas. Actually, we think that sometimes the power negotiations are suspended and Comunitas is created, but at the same time it's also a way to find empowerment and discuss power differences. So our dominant research question is what groups interact there in these communities, and what are the dominant groups, what are the subdominant groups, for instance, the healthy versus the sick, or the church authorities versus the common believers, all these oppositions. And the main research question is, in what ways do subdominant groups perform religion in Marian pilgrimage to challenge dominant power structures, and how are old religious practices given new significance when contextual power relations change? What are now the specific problems of comparison we encountered? Well, first, there was the problem of diversity in countries and continents. We have people working in Bolivia, France, Palestine, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea. So there are all these different countries, and it was just mentioned how that in itself can evoke problems of culturalism, tendency to look for the differences rather than the commonalities, because you really need to talk about each one specifically. Moreover, this problem was extended by the fact that we are all anthropologists. And if, you know, the trouble with anthropologists is that they're mostly interested in their own site, in their own the country that they are studying, and they're very well indoctrinated, as I might say, in the idea that it's important to specify, to contextualize, And moreover, anthropologists are not very well trained in comparison, and that's something that sociologists do. So what do we do as anthropologists with comparison in that respect? So here you can see images from Urcapiña in Bolivia, from Rwanda, from Egypt, and from France. And as anthropologists, we also valued a qualitative approach, or in anthropological terms, doing participant observation. And this means that we stay for a longer time in one site and make descriptions of the sites and the rituals executed there. And this led to interesting culturally specific descriptions of these different sites, but then how do you take the next step of comparison? Moreover, we followed a narrative approach to find out how people verbalize their religious experience. We aim to understand in depth by in-depth interviews while joining the pilgrims during their pilgrimage to gain insight in their specific religious meanings. We found that even individual pilgrims have a different story before they go, during the pilgrimage, or after they return. And so this poses another problem. How do you compare all these different stories? So what did we do to deal with these problems? Of course, we had to react to that. We had to find something to make this comparison. The first step we took was delimitation. It's the normal thing you do when you start a new research. We had to make choices. And one choice was not to take all saints, but only to take the Virgin Mary as the central icon. So we focused on Marian shrines. A second delimitation was a topical focus on specific inequalities. We defined which inequalities were most interesting to us, those on gender, on religion, and by religion I also mean Muslim versus Christian, or Muslim or Catholics versus Protestant, gender, health, class, and ethnicity. And a third delimitation was to maintain a clear theoretical focus on the power negotiations between the unequal groups. And in order to do so, we systematically analyzed the master narratives versus individual interpretations. Like Mohammed and Abdurrahman already discussed the faqir and how there were different interpretations of this happening. And actually, that we presuppose when we go into the field that there are different versions of reality, and we try to see who is saying what and which version becomes dominant and gains over the others, and why, and how this is connected with the social context and the power relations within that context. So we're very interested in imposing the normative, or finding out the normative structures versus the actual behavior of people. And for instance, a lot of times the church authorities want to differentiate the holy from the believers, while actually the believers want to go up to the Virgin and kiss her, and the authorities put her high in a grotto so that they can't kiss her. Another theoretical focus was to consider the pilgrimage as a complex performance, not only through words, but also through gestures and motions. People give meaning to their beliefs, but at the same time, they say something about their relations to others. So it's very important to look at postures, for instance. If they do this, they mean something else than if they do this. And so it's not only in words that people express themselves. Theoretical focus was moreover obtained by looking closely at the iconography, and in this case the iconography of Mary, and how this was perceived by the participants. And we depart from the multiplicity of meaning of central symbols, but also from the idea that these meanings are constantly negotiated. Let me give you an example. If a statue is erected at the pilgrimage site, this is the end product of a process of negotiation. For instance, the statue of Mary that you see in Lourdes was not the image that Bernadette saw. actually the image of Bernadette was negotiated with the authorities in order to find an image that was acceptable for the church, and the church finally decided which statue to put up. Not only the central statue, but also the other artifacts sold at pilgrimage sites, the souvenirs, the candles, the water, the ex-photos, are imbued by meaning. And as with the key symbol, this is not power neutral. And it is exactly this meaning in terms of power relations that we want to elicit. For instance, in Lourdes, the authorities really declare that the holy water is not holy. Don't expect miracles. But then, of course, all the believers go and get the holy water and define it as holy. Apart from various ways to delimit by making choices in topic, in object, and in theoretical focus, we try to enable comparison by developing a shared methodology. That is, all the researchers follow a same order. And the first thing was that we made a list of questions on the pilgrimage center that each researcher had to answer. And on this list was, for instance, questions on the object of devotion, the origin myth, the history, the kind of rituals, the objects used, and also, like Martine Boiteux stressed, the importance of the sacred topography of the sites, and in order to be able to compare these with the other sites. We also designed a common tool, which we call the photo elicitation method. And actually, it's a very simple tool, but I brought it with me. And it's a series of pictures of Mary. Because it was just said, it's difficult to study the individual religious practice, but it's even more difficult to study the individual religious beliefs. And if you ask a person what he or she believes, it's very difficult to answer. So we found that this tool was very practical because these are all images of Mary and they're all ethnically different. They express different virtues of the Virgin. And we found that if we showed them to people one by one and they can explain what they see and which they like, it opens up their ideas about the Virgin, about the sacred being. And not only that, we don't only ask them about their relation with the Virgin, but also how it connects with their everyday problems. And then sometimes pictures make them cry because they remind them of something very special in their life. And sometimes they kiss the picture, and even one person tried to steal the picture that she liked most. And this is an indication how it really moves people, although the non-believers, I mean, for non-believers this just doesn't say anything, but for the believers it's very important. And they identify with certain pictures, and for other pictures they just laugh and they said, ah, this is just a doll, it's not really serious. So these are some of the variations of the pictures that you know, black virgins, powerful virgins, mother and child, coronation. Moreover, we try to follow the pilgrims over time in order to show the complexification of religious experience. That is, we discuss the meaning of religion, in particular Mary, with them in their everyday life. And not only during the pilgrimage, but also after the pilgrimage or before, and what they thought about Mary. And we have very interesting study on Papua New Guinea and how Mary is connected both with the independence the violent independence movement of Bougainville, but also with everyday domestic violence. We do not only follow the pilgrims, but we also follow the things. And Kopitov has called that to make a biography of things, like the amulets, the statues, the souvenirs, and try to decide at what point, for instance, an object like water or a rosary becomes holy to the people, and what this holiness means in the way they deal with the object when they are at home and give it a special place in the home. And in order to compare the performative aspects, gestures and motions, we filmed the pilgrimage in order to illustrate not only the complexity and singularity of the pilgrimage, but also discover certain patterns. And this latter thing alone, I think, was a good idea, but it was very difficult even to make one film out of all these various films. So we sort of thought, well, this is something that didn't work, although it was a nice idea to do. A third set of responses to the problems of comparison, we think, is that it's important to realize why you would want to compare. Is it like the sociologists do, that you want to gather statistics on a comparison of how favored a certain pilgrimage site is or not? Or is it to compare in order to understand better whatever thing you are studying? So that's actually what we aim for. Rather than gaining insight by making broad generalizations, we aim to gain insight by showing the complexity and power-laden process of creating meaning. And this is a conference that we have in February, where we try to make the comparison and not only present our own research of the different participants, but also to find something that we have in common. Up to now, we have regular discussions, and it was indeed possible to get ideas from other people in order to better understand the specific pilgrimage center that each one is studying. It can also help to show the constraints and limitations of comparisons. For instance, we find out which specific meanings people give to their saints, but these can only be understood by placing them in the global expansion of dominant meanings that may limit individual creative freedom. Usually meanings are not individual. They are inspired by or variations of existing models. And even there are lots and lots of pictures of Mary. And sometimes, like in a church in Bethlehem, they try to depict all the variations, and you see various Marys, each in the ethnic costume of the people who donated it. But even despite this large variation, you can find that there are certain dominant models. And like the dominant model of the mother with child, the dominant model of the Mary Immaculate Conception, or the dominant model of the suffering mother. And all the others are sort of small variations on these dominant models that inspire the variations. That is the first case I want to discuss. The second one is the gender and possession on both sides of the Mediterranean. And this shows that how comparison can be useful in theorizing on a specific case. When doing research in Algeria in the 1980s, I, of course, came across or observed a trans ritual at a wedding. And it was the first time I saw something like that, and I was very much impressed. And, you know, the attraction of the exotic, you want to understand what really is going on. So I started to read on it and try to find explanations. And I found that it doesn't only happen in North Africa, but also that in Europe there's a long history of trans rituals during a lot of saint venerations. And on both sides of the Mediterranean, they were often related to saint veneration and often took place during pilgrimage. And moreover, I discovered a gender bias that we shortly talked about yesterday, in that there were probably far more women involved, not so much in leading the ritual or among the musicians, but among those who became possessed. And if we look all over the world, we find more women than men in the Macumba in Brazil, the Zar in Egypt, the Dionysian rituals in Greece, the Tarantula in Italy, the Saint Vitus dance in Germany. All you find there seems to be overrepresentation of women. So then I have this question, why? I mean, why are there more women than men? And also in this research, I came across a lot of, the problems of comparison. A first problem was that some authors said, well, this is not religion, this is possession by the devil, especially among the Christians you find that. I mean, it's rejected, and it's certainly not religion, it's the opposite of religion. And in this context, it was also very important to distinguish between trance and possession, whereas trance, you can fall into trance by going to the disco or by using drugs, but this is not necessarily religious. Religious, it becomes at the moment that there's a connection with the supernatural, when the trance in itself is explained by a possession by spirits or a connection with God or with saints or with Junun. Another problem was that I had this hunch of there being more women than men, but I wasn't sure. And I was looking in the literature, and a lot of times it was mentioned, but no one really gave proof or figures. And a third problem was this problem of historical timing. Could I compare the ritual of Sidi Abdel Kader in Algeria with the ritual of the Saint Willibrord in Luxembourg, which took place ages difference between them? So the comparison over historical times and the danger of those. So how could I deal with these problems? The first one was to try to start with an emic approach, which means that you define religion by the way, well, what we normally all do, whether the person involved called it religious or not. And what how do they classify it themselves? And then it's very interesting to compare the individual interpretations with the normative interpretations. And this is also this approach we systematically apply in the pilgrimage project. The contestation itself should be subject to research. Who is saying that it is religion and who is saying that it's not? And why would they say so? And which power relations are involved here? So the disagreement in itself is interesting as a form of power negotiation. And there's also a difference between Islam and Christianity in this respect, because in Islam it was far longer accepted as a regular form of religion, because Sufism was the dominant religion for a very long time. So it was for a long time it was rather normal to do that. So asking about your question, why don't the anthropologists study the normal? Well, actually, for a long time, Sufism was the normal way of doing religion, I think, in North Africa. It's just only now, because there other forms have arisen, that you have this rejection of subdominant forms. The second one, the multiple sources, was a reaction to this question of lack of proof. There were no figures, but there were visual sources. So if you look at the visual sources of different age periods, then you see that in this depiction of the Dionysian ritual, it's again the woman who falls in trance. If you look at the procession of Saint John, painted by Peter Bruegel, you also see that it's the women who are in trance, and it's the men who make the music or support them. And also the latter picture, someone mentioned this artist yesterday or the other day, it's a Moroccan artist, and also here you see that the woman is the person who is in trance. So from these multiple sources, you can sort of say that probably there's a over predominance of women. There's one exception, however, and that might be interesting for Abdelmajid, because I found this exception in the sources on the Gnawa, who went to Europe in the Middle Ages. And they were troops who traveled around the European courts, And it's interesting to see, because also there the main character involved is a woman, but the woman apparently is an elite woman, and she stands aside, and then the troupe performs for her, and it's one of the males of the troupe who falls in trance, sort of a replacement for the woman himself. If you give me your email, I will send you the pictures if you like to have these, because it's a continuation of internationalization of Gnawa rituals. The over-representation was confirmed by these images in general, and they show a similarity with the present participation of women in trance rituals, but they do not explain it. We still are left with the question, why are there more women than men? And I will show later that we need various theories to solve that. But first, we have to solve another, the third problem mentioned, that of comparison over time. Comparison of trance rituals over longer periods of time can show us the extent of variance and change. Comparison over time, for instance, can show why at a certain moment more men participated than at present. Under some circumstances, men tend to participate more frequently, and that has to do, in my view, with the dominant form of religion that is acceptable at a certain moment. As I said, Sufism was the dominant religion at a certain moment, and at that time, men predominated and participated in the dhikr and other types of rituals. At the moment that when there is a change and it becomes more marginalized, then you see that it sort of moves from the street into the private homes, and it's there where women take over and are the main participants. Despite the cultural and historical differences, it might be interesting to look at the ritual and analyze the symbolic structure of the ritual itself, and to see if there are similarities and differences. And remarkable are that, and I won't focus on the difference here, but on the similarities, especially the similarities in performative aspects that we can note. First procession trance is often part of pilgrimage to saints, expressed as a form of submission to a saint or spirit, or one seeks healing for physical, emotional, or social ailments from the saint or spirit. And here you see the possessed in front of Saint Ignatius of Loyola. In an analysis of the ritual, possession rituals are interpreted as spiritual experience. From here comes the difference, as I said, between trance and possession, an altered state of mind due to the intervention of external being, a spirit, a jinn, or a saint, or God. What these pictures also reveal is how social this religious experience is. One needs the support of a group, firstly musicians, secondly supporters to guide the ritual and lead the possessed. And here in this picture of a tarantula in Italy, you see the woman dancing with the scarf. And I don't know if you know the rituals in Morocco, you find that at a certain moment the scarf is very important, because the woman in trance tends to fall down on the floor, and in order not to hurt herself, other women would hold her with the scarf. So this scarf is expressive of the social support people give. And we find it here again, but in a very stylized, symbolic way, in the ritual of Saint Willebrod in Luxembourg. And this takes place up to this day. I mean, it's still a practice going on during the pilgrimage to Saint Willebrod. And of course, it's no longer functional, but expresses the symbolic means by which people are connected. The pictures also show similar means of trance induction, first by rhythmic movements, body movements, which is also the reason why it's often called dance, although it differs fundamentally from dance. And you can hear that when you can listen to the music. The music is very important. There are always drums. And not only that, there's also rhythmic movement in terms of the light. A lot of these pilgrimages, the people dance versus the sun. And by doing this like that, you get a hyperventilation effect, which is the same as you see in the Jitba in North Africa. We also want to compare cases in order to get theoretical suggestions. As I said, I was confronted with this experience and I did not know how to explain it. Studies of other situations may suggest theoretical answers which could be or might not be valuable for our specific case. Even if the phenomenon shows itself in a very similar way, the cause of it might be different at different particular social contexts or at different periods of time. So I studied the literature and tried, this is the submission and the movement and dance. This is an Algerian depiction. Also the importance of colors for specific scenes and specific rhythms, which we saw also in the movie yesterday. I tried to find, or I categorized the different theories on the explanation of the gender question in trance rituals. And the first one was theological explanations, and in particular the ones on Christian possession. And as I said, in Christianity it was always connected with the devil and with low status groups, and women were a low status group, so it was also for this reason that a lot of women ended their life at the stake, because they were burned as witches, and these were also the groups that participated in such rituals or that were thought to be possessed by the devil. These theological explanations are not very interesting to answer my questions, but they are actually part of the problem. Because why do people say these things, and who are they to explain it? Other authors explain possession trance and the gender question as an expression of the power conflict between men and women, like body. In cases where the possessed speak in tongues, conflicts that normally cannot be spoken about can now be verbalized, because it's not the woman but the spirits who speak and who reveal the problem. By claiming that she needs a trance session or otherwise, she would fall ill. And I don't know if you have studied, for instance, which families invited the Gnawa and for what reasons they invited the Gnawa. But you can imagine that women usually demand from their husband, well, if you don't let me do this ritual, it costs a lot of money, because they have to slaughter sheep and pay for the Gnawa, then I will really fall ill. And that's also why these doors are open and other neighbors can come in, because if the neighbors hear it and they can't come in, then they also might fall ill if they cannot answer to the call of the saints or the spirits. Closely connected to this interpretation is that of other theorists who mention possession as a psychotherapy. It's a human capacity to fall into trance, but not everybody does it. I mean, there are a lot of participants or onlookers, but only a few people really fall in trance. And in my own work on possession in Algeria, I have shown that in particular, people who cannot live up to their gender norms are more liable to suffering from what is called the dancing disease. And this finding is corroborated by others. For instance, Crapanzano did a very interesting study on Morocco, and he showed that a lot of these men who participated in the rituals were men who could not live up to the norms of masculinity. They were homosexuals, they were handicapped and could not marry, they were poor, and they were more liable than others to be pulled into the trance ritual. And the same I found among the women, because whenever a woman would fall in trance, all the other women around would discuss what her problem was. And the problem was maybe that her husband had left her for another woman, that her children had died, that she was a prostitute. And as I said yesterday, in some areas you find the zawiyas next to the brothels, because somehow they're connected. They are for people who have problems, and those are drawn into the ritual. So participation in the ritual can be seen as a psychotherapy and a social therapy as such, because it expresses what's the problem with the person and makes it public. And then the public can try to negotiate, for instance, with the husband and also the fault is not left with the woman or with the man in that case, because it's Aisha Qandisha who has possessed the man, or it's the spirits, Sidi Mimoun or whatever, who has possessed the woman, and it's not her fault that she can't have children, but it's the saint's fault or the jinn's fault. So gender deviancy creates liability. And then there's another set of theories which are more related to the body, to the human body, and to medical aspects of the human body. Authors like Lex, Barbara Lex, have focused on the importance of the drums and the effects drums have on brain waves. And they say if people have psychological problems, their brain waves are disturbed. So if you retune them, they get better and they feel well. And these authors reduce possession to a trance experience and explain it as an induced neurobiological project by which brain disturbances are tuned again, like if you have these old-fashioned radios that are off-tune, you just turn them until they become audible again. Although this may explain the neurobiological process, it doesn't explain my question of why more women than men, because would that mean that there's something wrong with the brainwaves of women and more than with the brainwaves of men? So this is an open question that has not been studied by these authors. Kehu and Giletti offered another explanation. They also were concerned with the body, but especially with the food intake. And they said if we do a comparison of different cultures where transpossession is dominant, we see that these are all grain cultures and that it especially occurs among layers of society that have a deficient food intake. So they call it the calcium deficiency hypothesis. And they concluded that it's a food problem, and this could connect with the gender problem, because in poor societies we see that women get less food and sometimes need more specific food, especially calcium types of food, because they become pregnant, because they lactate. So they are more likely to have these deficiencies than men would have, which might explain their overrepresentation. The problem with grain also is that if you have in situations of famine or in situations of drought or floods, that it can be contaminated with the ergo. And this is a fungus that grows on grain and it turns it black. And this fungus has, it's like a drug and it makes you hallucinate. And also here there's a connection with women, because ergo is used in traditional medicine and it's still used in Western medicine, because up to this moment this very specific substance is used to stop the bleeding after women have given birth. So this could also be an explanation why there are more women than men participating. So these theories are quite plausible, I think, to explain the large outbreaks of possession trance in Algeria around 1900, but they might be less applicable at the moment when there's more access to food and when there's more development in that respect. amassing all these theories is interesting because it opens new perspective from which to analyze a specific material, as long as we realize that explanations can be more important in one period, and then in other periods other explanations come up. So what can we conclude from this exposé for our research for religion, and how can it help my research or your research? In the foregoing, I have made some suggestions for better comparison by delimiting the object, theories and methods of research, by consistently applying a certain theoretical focus, by using a shared methodology directed at gathering similar types of data, and by not being afraid to find multiple interpretations or to use multiple sources, and by valuing the inspiration of theoretical discussions done elsewhere. The most important, however, is the need to reflect on the reasons why you do want to compare. Are you looking for general trends, or do you see comparison as a way to better understand the complex phenomenon that you're studying? And I must confess, as I did in the beginning, we still feel a little bit uncomfortable with this task. So I would like to ask you, how do you go about comparison, and what could you suggest in our project? Thank you.